Hello, you are listening to Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and writers. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today is April the 6th, 2009. I'm here with Meg Wolitzer, the author of, most recently, The 10-Year Nap. Hello, Meg, and thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, David.
Despite some of the technological challenges that I've presented, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this book. It takes place in New York City. And it, you know, the temptation, I think, for many readers, at least from what I've read sometimes online about your work, is to think of it as being autobiographical. And you've talked about that somewhat, and maybe you could just sort of delve into that a little bit and talk about how you write and whether it is autobiographical or not.
I've never written anything that I would consider really autobiographical. I don't really write about my life, but I do sometimes write about the world around me. I mean, I think always write about the world around me, I guess, because in The 10-Year Nap, the title refers to the phenomenon of women who stop working when their children are born, and suddenly it's a decade later, and they are trying to think about what to do with the rest of their lives and how to proceed. And this is something that I have not experienced. I've always worked, I've always had a job, I've always wanted to, and I've always had to for money. But when I had kids, I met some women who had had previous lives as lawyers or heads of companies, and I knew them now as Jared's mom or something else like that. And I didn't know them in their previous incarnations, and it was interesting to me to see how they'd let that go and what they'd let go and who they were now and what their vulnerabilities were. And while it wasn't my daily experience, I saw it around me in New York. And I set the book in New York not because I want it to only be strictly, obviously, read by New Yorkers or anything like that, but it seemed to me, because it's a center of affluence, it's a place where women sometimes can afford to stop working, or at least when I wrote this book. And I wanted to sort of make it somewhat of a microcosm of that idea, really.
And do you feel that the women that are in the book, are they... I mean, the way you treated them was very gentle, I thought, and very fair. You know, it wasn't that you were not heavy-handed presenting them judgmentally. I mean, there's always the temptation, I think, that maybe in some nonfiction is to present, and that's maybe the difference. It's sociological versus creative. Mm-hmm. But of the women in the story, are there any that you, I mean, did you identify with one over all others?
I don't think I identified with one over all those. I did like the character of Jill, who's someone who always was meant to succeed in a very big way. She won the most promising at her prep school, and she was meant to have a big academic career, and she basically bombed out on her dissertation, and that was the end of that. And then she tried to have a baby and was infertile and couldn't believe that her life took this sharp turn and wasn't going the way she meant for it to. And I felt a lot of tenderness toward her in particular. I mean, if you don't feel tender toward your characters, who will, really? But all of the characters are, they're not me, they're not even my friends, per se, but they are women who I understand. And I think that is really the primary criterion when you're creating a character.
Well, and it felt like, I think for most readers, you know, that, well, I can't say, it's hard to speak for most readers. I can speak for myself.
Oh, go ahead. Be their representative.
Yeah, but I think, you know, clearly there are many people who identified with, or who will identify with either the women, or it doesn't have to be women, it could be men, in that position of looking around at your life and trying to figure out, how did I get here?
Right.
You know, like the Talking Heads song, famously.
This is not my beautiful wife.
Right, this is not my beautiful house. Yeah. But also it's that sense of the twists and turns that life takes. And, you know, I felt that the book definitely had its place in time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain groundings that were unique to that period and may not be reproducible.
Right.
Or that the women... And I think you talked about this quite a bit, that the women, or at least in the case of Amy, that her mother had been a sort of scion of feminism and was therefore a big influence on her. And you contrasted, perhaps, you know, the women of that generation with the next women, or the next generation. But again, there was no judgmentalness in your approach. It was much more like a slice of life.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you felt that way, because it wasn't my place to judge or to say how people should live their lives. I mean, that's the last thing I would really ever want to do. There are enough books that do that, and there are enough talk shows that do that. I think a novel can just show what life is like, and my only goal for myself was really to say, what is it like for women who stop working? And it's really, really a novel about the middle of life, and I wanted to show what is it like when you take stock.
And, of course, some of the characters come off better than others. I think, the one in particular that I thought, well, actually, I thought Roberta, who is the woman who is the failed artist,
mm-hmm.
I guess she is a failed artist.
Yeah, pretty much.
But it's complicated. Her life is very complicated. And, you know, she has this sudden, I thought it was also interesting when her husband, has this amazing success out of nowhere. But, of course, he excludes her from that success. So, but then she... and I probably should, you should describe it, but what happens is that she, acting on her impulse to be politically active, unlike any of the other women in the story, she's trying to do something concrete,
mm-hmm.
Goes to South Dakota to volunteer to drive someone to a Planned Parenthood clinic for an abortion, and then connects with the young woman in South Dakota and offers to help her become an artist. And then completely bombs out on it and doesn't mm-hmm. succeed. And I thought she really, I'm judgmental, but I felt that she was the one in maybe of all the others that you were the most, I don't want to say hard on, but, you know, that she was just kind of presented as being complex in that
right.
not necessarily positive way.
No, I did have to show that Roberta does something that we would consider unconscionable, and it seemed right to me. That, you know, you can contain multitudes. And I think in her case, a kind of envy takes over. And I think envy's profound in a lot of people, and especially for Roberta, who is frustrated. Because just because you know what you love to do doesn't mean that you're going to succeed at it. I mean, there's so many levels. On the one hand, for me, coming of age with a feminist mother, I was really told, you know, do what you love to do. And it was the greatest thing that she said that to me, absolutely. But not everybody found the thing that they love to do and could do. And not all jobs are something that you love. Not all jobs are somebody's passion. I didn't really realize that when I was growing up. And even if you find it, as Roberta thinks she did, you might not necessarily make it. And how is that if you don't make it and suddenly, say, your husband does, which does happen in this book?
Yeah.
What happens to a marriage? So it brought out not the best in her, absolutely. But I, you know, had to be willing to do that. You know, readers have asked me about that, and I guess, you know, one was sort of angry about it, felt that, why did you ever do this thing? And that sort of speaks to the kind of literalist impulse that I think a lot of readers, and any reader really, can fall prey to, because it feels so real.
Well, it's confusing. As, you know, as we watch television, we see characters every day, and we think... and then you see them on the street, and you forget that, George Clooney is not the character on ER.
Right.
You know, so you go up, people go, you know, these stories there are stories of people going up to the character and, you know,
telling them.
Yeah, like you shouldn't have done that in that story.
Right.
Like somehow the imaginative world, the boundary between fiction and reality is blurred.
Right.
Probably by television more than by...
I think it's blurred, really, whenever there's a visual medium. I think the visual sort of just takes over and surrounds us in a way that that reading requires sort of a funnel, you know, that you sort of funnel everything down onto the page or the iPhone or whatever you're reading on these days. And with movies, you're in darkness and you're surrounded, and there is that sense of being enveloped. And I think it does almost hypnotize viewers in a way.
Yeah, but I think also with writing, I think that when you capture the imagination of a reader, we have then that kind of contradiction. You know, the characters come to life for us, and of course, readers often then maybe, and again, I don't know why this happens, but we find ourselves trying to figure out why the writer did that,
mm-hmm.
and it's a reductivist move. It's not fair. In a certain way, but it's almost like this desire to always be able to understand the writing.
Yeah, to break the code.
Right, and then that means we have to psychoanalyze the writer, which, you know, to me is not really correct. I don't believe in the psychoanalysis view of, you know, all writing is an expression of some unresolved issue. It doesn't have to be that way, I think. But of course, you know, then there's that issue is all writing autobiographical on some level or another? And it's possible to say it is, but it doesn't need to be, as you said, it doesn't need to be literal.
Right.
It can be a psychological reality. It can be an imaginative autobiography. You don't have to have experienced everything. And I assume you did not experience everything in this
or
book.
Anything.
Right. So that, you know, but people, you know, people, readers, all of us are prone to kind of try to figure out how it happened. And
there
is, then, you know, we don't do enough willing suspension of disbelief that, you know, just jump in and live it.
Yeah, sometimes writers make choices that are based really on instinct, and they go against even the whole superstructure that they've created throughout the course of the book. They suddenly want to do something. I mean, or in a story, like Chekhov would, you know, suddenly goes to the point of view of a dog on the street, right? And then goes back to the story. And that defies the rules. It's not strictly earned, right, to do something like that. And yet, it's okay, because he earned it in some other way. You know, you get a sense when you've been writing for a while of that you want to try something that feels right to you, and you can't even explain to anybody why it would feel right to you. Or maybe the person who would understand it is a consummate reader or a consummate writer, too.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. I love that notion of the ideal reader, that, you know, when you write, famously, I think for me anyway, the poet Robert Duncan always imagined a 67-year-old English teacher. That was his ideal reader. I don't know why that
great.
Is.
Yeah.
But is there somebody do you visualize someone that you're writing to or not?
It's changed a bit over time. When I was really young, I would write for my mother and would run in and show her just anything, any haiku, and she would say, "That's wonderful." Now, she would tell you that she was not indiscriminate, that she liked some more than others, but she was always supportive. And then I wrote for teachers, and this too was a good thing. And then I wrote for college professors. I took a bunch of writing classes in college.
Did you get an MFA?
No, I just have a BA. I sold my first novel when I was a senior at Brown, and then I struck out into the world. I hope I didn't strike out. I was actually all set to go to Stanford and do a doctoral program. And I sold my first novel, Sleepwalking, and decided to go to New York, and I got a fellowship to go to the McDowell Colony, and sold my novel for $5,000. I was very excited. And just have been living as a writer, and I've done teaching and all kinds of things since then. But, you know,
have you had different editors over time?
Yes, I have, absolutely.
And, you know, and do you have a relationship with an editor now that is kind of back and forth?
Yeah, I have a wonderful relationship with an editor who has edited the previous three novels, The Tenure Nap, The Position, and The Wife, and I hope many more to come. And I, you know, she would be the first person I would show things to. But what I feel now is that the person, your ideal reader, in a way, you finally want to banish them, and then you can really write. Then you can kick it up to a new level, or at least that's the fantasy, I guess. You know, kill the first grade teacher, and then you're really going to be writing the stuff, that line that's so great, and I don't know who said it, but that you should write as if everyone you know were dead. because, you know, when you're writing to please somebody, you can really do a lot of work. You can really find what's ingratiating about yourself and what you care about. And when you're not doing that anymore, you're out on a ledge and you're just alone in the world. And
takes courage.
Yeah, and it's definitely does. And you don't get that gratification, because the thing, the 67-year-old librarian or the teacher or the mother, I mean, there's an expectation that they are going to say, "We love you."
Yeah, well, but it must be. I mean, that's a terrible thing for any writer, I think.
Yeah.
That always that risk.
They might say they don't love you, in which case you're very panicky. Well, you know, writers, unlike performers, have long, long periods of no gratification. It's just horrible. I mean, I was at something recently with a lot of actors, and I thought, oh my God, they finished reading a script, and everybody clapped, And they do that sort of thing every day. Whereas when you're a writer and you give a reading, you know, they're whenever you give a reading. But every day when you write a paragraph that you love, no one claps. You don't even show it to anyone. You're not showing it to that librarian or that teacher. You kind of maybe go for a walk.
Right. You have to internalize the whole thing.
Yeah.
No, I think that, and for a novelist, it's a long period of time, and it could be rewrites. So, no,
yeah,
I think you have to be very strong within yourself.
And patient, yeah.
Yeah, and that's hard to do. I think that's kind of the separation, probably, between the wannabe writer and the actual writer to a great extent.
To tolerate things.
Yeah, and also, but also that confidence or that ability to know within oneself that it doesn't matter in the end whether, I mean, of course you want everybody to like it, but that's not why you're writing it.
No, of course not.
It's your own internal imperative.
Right, yeah.
So are you've described yourself as working feverishly at times and then sort of being fallow at other times.
Right.
Are you in a writing period?
Yeah,
right
I'm
now?
In a writing period right now. The fallow period though is often like right out like when the hardcover of The Tenure Nap came out. I had to do, you know, quite a bit of publicity, and I was talking about the book and talking about the book, and then I was just so worn out, I cleaned closets for a while. And I think that it's a regenerative time when that's happening. It definitely, you can't see it happening. But things are going on a cellular level, most definitely. And I enjoy that, too. But I do like writing. I do like working. And one of the characters in The Tenure Nap says that, you know, work is the anti-death. And someone else says work is a tonic. And I think, for me, that's both are true.
And would you feel like when you're not writing, but you don't have that sense that some writers have, you know, if they're not writing, there's something wrong, it bothers them, that they feel like they're just uncomfortable?
Oh, no, I've never had what I would consider a block. I mean, my mother had a 12-year period when she didn't write, and she didn't understand why it went away, and then she didn't understand why it came back, but it did. And it is mysterious. I mean, the whole thing is kind of mysterious. And if I'm not writing, it would be a long time before I considered it a block. Maybe it would be somewhat resistant, but I would assume that something was going on. You know, there's a kind of sea change in reading right now, and I think that that's probably affecting writers too.
You mean in terms of devices and
devices, but also attention span. Yeah, I was thinking of it more in terms of attentional issues than the technological ones. You know, there's a feeling that a long, long book, people can't handle that. But what does that mean? Are you going to therefore write a shorter book? You know, or is Moby Dick going to be a pamphlet? I mean, I don't think so.
It is a really interesting question. I think, you know, in conversations that I have with people in the book business, which is more about the writing business, you know, not about the literalness of writing, but of kind of the delivery system and trying to figure out what is happening with audiences, I think there is a sense of fragmentation of attention span that may, who knows what happens? It may affect how people write literally,
not just how they
read.
We don't really know. Exactly. But then a book comes along that defies everything. And I think that the idea of tailoring a book to an audience is always a mistake.
Well, the one I'm most interested in right now is 2666.
In fact, I just was thinking about that, because who would have thought? You can get it in a one volume, you can get it in a three volume and carry part of it around, and people love it. It's great, and it's exciting
it's
to read,
book.
And it's a big book, and it's a big commitment.
Right.
And people are saying, I don't have time. I don't have time to have drinks. I can't. I'm too tired. And here's this book that's really, really long.
Right. And look at the kids reading. My kids read Harry Potter.
Right.
Huge, long books over and over again.
Right.
So I don't think it is literally always clear how things are going to be.
No, it isn't. So all you can do as a writer is write the book you want to write.
Absolutely.
I mean, otherwise,
it's just... It would be like turning your back on who you are.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah.
write to what you imagine the audience
right.
would be.
No,
I think that's right. But still, you know, as a kind of intellectual item of curiosity, how will things be in our culture in the future is something that we all, well, not everybody, I suppose, but I certainly think about.
But I think there will always be exceptions. There are always books that have this X factor that you didn't know. That, you know,
that's
how
right.
could that book do well? Or how could... a book about dogs that's Hamlet, like the story of Edgar Sautel, you know, do well. Who knows? It's all mysterious. And you know, I think for a book to do well, people actually have to like it. They have to like it, not just feel it's good for them. They have to enjoy it so that they'll tell their friends, I loved this book.
Well, so just as a, what would be, what is there a book that you can identify right now as one that you feel really strongly about in that way that you would recommend to people?
A current book? I can't. I don't know that I can think of a current book. I mean, I have so many books going at all the, you know, all times.
Well, just a book that, like right now, if I said, what would be a book that you would really think you'd recommend? So you've got to go read that book.
Oh, well, my favorite novel, I guess, is Mrs. Bridge by Evanus Cannell. And I love this book. And, you know, it's considered, in some sense, a writer's book, although lots of non-writers know and love this book, and it's stayed in print for a very long time. And, you know, it's about a Kansas housewife in the 1930s before the war. And it's just the story of this woman's life, but it's funny and tragic and many, many things. It's really laugh-out-loud funny. And it's just this story of this woman who wants to sort of better herself and get outside of herself and can't quite do it. And it's therefore a story of awareness of consciousness and limitations. And I think it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And it's written in a very epigrammatic style. They're very short sections. And I think of readers now sort of not wanting to be overwhelmed with text. If they feel that way, read Mrs. Bridge, because it's really, it's a beautiful and perfect novel.
Well, that seems like a pretty good place for us to end. I want to thank you, Meg Wolitzer, for coming and talking to me. The book that we've been talking about is The 10-Year Nap. It's not your only book, and I would recommend others to people who are interested in your work, because I think you have a really wonderful way of writing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.